Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton and our producer, Katie Galley. Another episode of Atlanta Business Radio, and this will be a fun one, Stone.
Hey, this is going to be a fantastic show today. First up on Atlanta Business Radio, please join me in welcoming to the broadcast CEO with Lease Query, Mr. George Ozzie. How are you, sir?
Doing well. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, George, can you tell us a little bit about Lease Query? How are you serving folks?
What we're trying to solve here is a regulatory problem. If you've heard of Enron, Enron went bankrupt a little bit because of lease liabilities that they had that they really didn't record in their balance sheet. So as a result of that, the Financial Accounting Standards Board decided to make changes. So now companies are required to report operating leases on their balance sheet as liabilities. Think about it as if you rent an apartment complex and you rent this apartment complex. Right now, you didn't get a loan, right? Because you don't own the apartment. So as a result, now you would have to actually record a liability on your personal financial statement as if you had actually signed a debt covenant.
So me as the person who's leasing?
Yes, as the renter. So our solution basically goes out there and you enter all your leases into the system and it tells you how much you have to record on your balance sheet as debt. Well, it's really not debt, but that's the easiest way to explain it.
But it doesn't affect the actual person, like in this, you use the apartment complex as an example. So the person who's in the apartment has to...
Well, it's not really a solution for individuals, right? This is a solution for companies. Mm-hmm. So most companies lease everything. So if you fly in an airplane, Delta Airlines, those airplanes are actually leased by the airline, right? They're not purchased. So those liabilities, those lease liabilities are not reflected on their balance sheet. Mm-hmm. So because once again, they do not own it, right?
Right.
They did not go purchase it. They didn't go to get a loan to purchase it. As a result, that liability is what's called an off-balance sheet transaction. So that's essentially what happened to Enron, right? You go sign a 30-year lease. I mean, this is an oversimplification, but you go sign a 30-year lease and nowhere on that, on your financial statement, does it state that you owe a company or an individual, you know, thousands of dollars over 30 years, mm-hmm. right? So that's the problem that the boards are trying to solve.
So whenever there's kind of a miscellaneous pile, then you want to create regulation around it so you can see what's really, you can unpack that a little bit.
That's exactly right. So if you were to loan me money right now, right, wouldn't you want to know who else I owe?
Right.
Right. So now, if I had gone out there and I signed a 30-year lease or a 10-year lease with an apartment with, you know, where I live, right, wouldn't you want to know that every month for the next 10 years, I owe X person $2,000?
Right.
Well, that's exactly the problem we're solving. The challenge is right now, companies do not have to report that they owe this certain amount to another individual.
Now, right? do the companies think that's a challenge or do they like it that way?
They do like it that way. That's a very good point. They do like it that way. So if you consider two individuals or two companies out there, right? One company goes out and purchases the asset. So they go get a loan to fund said purchase of the asset. Another company goes and just signs a 10-year lease for the same exact asset. Which one do you think looks better?
Right, the one that least looks better because
that's exactly right.
It's not shown.
That's exactly right. It's not displayed on their financial statements.
Right.
So the boards are trying to equal the playing field, right? To make it seem as if, okay, you chose to lease because you're going to have this off-balance sheet liability treatment. So in this case, we're going to bring it forward. So that's really, it's a big change. Hasn't happened in 70 years.
So now, 40 years. Has it happened?
Yes. The rules are finally out. That's really what's surging our growth. Mm-hmm. Right, we had 913% growth. I know we have documents out there that
wow.
said 873, but that was because we had to get that number prior mm-hmm. to getting it out to press.
So now, because the regulations has changed, you have the solution that makes it easy to keep track of this.
That's exactly right. So we have a lot of clients out there that have, you know, thousands of leases. The thing is, everyone thinks about this as a real estate problem. It's really not a real estate play because most companies lease the vast majority of their equipment. Mm-hmm. So if you really think about it, forklifts, vehicles, buildings, computer equipment, right? Companies lease all these assets and all these are affected by the new lease accounting rules. Every single asset has to be reflected as a liability on your books.
So now what is the sweet spot now that you're aiming at?
Well, this is a company that this is a problem that affects all companies, right? As long as you have to issue what are called GAAP financials. So if you have to issue GAAP financials, you have to comply. So our smallest client has 13 leases, which is actually based out here in the Atlanta area. And our largest client has over 25,000.
Wow, 25,000. So now how does your solution work? Is it software?
Yes, it's software as a service. So basically it's based on the number of assets, lease assets that you have. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times you'll actually see that companies have a portfolio of assets, right? So if you want to lease forklifts, for instance, you're not going to go sign one forklift and one forklift and another, right? You're going to have a master lease with a schedule of forklifts underneath mm-hmm. that. So we charge by the asset. So that's really what fuels kind of the growth there.
Now, what about the implementation from the user perspective? Is it something they just scan in the lease document, or how does it
kind well, of a populate? Lot of so the challenge there is that a lot of times this is lease accounting, right? So even though it seems simple from reading the lease, there's some intricacies that could be written into the contract that could have significant implications on the accounting for it, right? So for instance, when does a lease start, right? Is it the date of execution? Is it the date you open for business over there? Is it the date you actually gain access to the property?
Right.
What is that date? So an accountant, this is a very simple question for an accountant to answer. However, for anybody else reading the lease, they may not know, right? It's ambiguous.
So what's the answer?
The date of possession. The date of possession, that's the answer.
So the person inputting the stuff has to know that.
That's exactly right.
So they have to know some accounting.
Well, that's where we come in, right? Uh-huh. We help you actually understand your leases from an accountant's perspective. So once again, it's an accounting problem. We hire the vast majority of our employees are accountants. So they understand exactly how to account for it in terms of accounting.
Mm-hmm. So now you mentioned that the regulation changed recently. So now your solution seems to be dovetail perfectly into an opportunity here.
That's exactly right.
So now what's it like kind of managing a company that's going through this explosive growth when for a while it probably was slow moving because there was no really urgency to getting to doing this?
Well, a lot of Starbucks, right? very, very little sleep. We've quadrupled in size. We're a different company every month. Right. The challenge there is finding good people, right, and finding people who really understand the problem that we're trying to solve. Mm-hmm. We're not venture backed, right? We fund our growth through our clients paying
through the customers.
That's exactly right.
I like customer funded companies. So, what is your backstory? How'd you land here?
Well, I used to be an auditor in financial institutions. So banks.
So recovering auditor.
I am a recovering auditor. Right. That's exactly right. I am a recovering auditor. I worked in public accounting for 4 years. And then after that, in 2008, left for obvious reasons, the financial crash. Then I went to go work in a large, I guess they're Fortune 50 something now, in the Atlanta area. And what I did there was accounting and research. So technical accounting and accounting research. As it relates to that, that was kind of how I saw that this problem was coming up. My role there was to make sure that whatever new pronouncements the boards were making, I would make sure that we would get the appropriate accounting treatment that we needed.
Mm-hmm. So now, what was it like kind of creating a software as a service when you're not like a technologist by trade?
Well, I was a technologist by night.
So you were doing the coding and
no. So that's what's also very different about us, right? We are accountants first. So rather than having to go hire a consultant, right? The accounting, the coding is a bunch of ones and zeros, right? All you need to do is say what it needs to do is this. That's the most important part of building technology is that you see it from the customer's
from
perspective.
From the user's standpoint.
That's exactly right. So I didn't need to go hire a bunch of consultants to tell me what to do.
Right. You know what it was supposed to look like when it was done.
That's exactly right.
But you may not know how to build it.
That's exactly right. And so I hired people to do it. So I had two jobs at one point where, that's literally called bootstrapping, right? Went and bootstrapped the business myself.
So you just had this idea that this is going to come around, that at some point they're going to regulate this?
Well, essentially what happened, full disclosure, was that the company I was working for, our auditors were Ernst & Young, right? Accounting, big accounting firm. They came and tested our leases and 10 out of 10 of them were wrong. They came and tested another 10 and 10 out of 10 of them were wrong. And so they, the chief accounting officer said, you know, tasked me with teaching the controllers. This was a multinational corporation, global corporation, and each kind of unit had its own controller. And the challenge there was that the controllers did not understand the accounting. So what we, so the controller, the chief accounting officer tasked me with teaching the controllers exactly how to account for leases. In doing that, preparing my presentation, I said, there has to be software that does this.
Right.
Right. I mean, this is simple accounting under current standards. And I looked around at everyone that, you know, claims to be a competitor now, looked at everything that they said and that they had, and none of them solved the problem. Right. They had all these bells and whistles, but none of them solved the accounting piece, which is a small, slight piece, simple under today, under today's guidance. But once again, in my role as you know, technical accounting and accounting research, I knew that they were about to make this more complex. And my thought process was, well, if, I mean, this is a $7 billion corporation. If we have this problem and no one's solving it now,
at this level,
when it becomes more complex, I mean, it's going to be a real headache out there. So that's really what.
So at first you were solving it for just an internal auditing problem.
Correct.
But you saw that, you foresaw that there might be opportunity once it gets regulated for everybody. It won't just be an internal auditing problem. It'll be an everybody problem.
That's exactly right. I mean, it was an everybody problem at that time too. The challenge once again was that these assets were not reflected on financial statements. So companies frankly didn't care.
Right. There was no urgency.
There was no sense of urgency. That's exactly right.
And then as soon as they regulate it, now I got to do it. So now I've got to figure
now,
it out.
That's
it's
exactly
now my problem.
That's exactly right.
So how does the whole sales and marketing thing work now? Because now you have people in the companies that know they've got to solve this problem. They've got to close this gap. Now they're coming out to the marketplace and trying to figure out who can help them. Or you've got folks out there shaking the trees and letting them know as quickly as possible, hey, we've got a solution for this thing.
Well, up until, as I said, we experienced 913% growth. All pretty much every single one of that was from inbound. Right. What we did is we have our marketing process was writing blogs. Right. And essentially, as it relates to the blogs, the types of blogs we wrote, you could tell right away that we were accountants. If you are reading our blog and you land on our page and you spend more than 2 minutes, you are a potential client. I mean, you're a client. It's not even a potential client. So that's really what we do. Another thing we tell our clients to do when they compare us with our competition is do a review. Just do your due diligence and do a review. If you look at our competitors, you'll notice one simple thing. Everyone is going to get a 5-star rating, right? But look at who, the title of the individual leaving the rating. That's really what matters, right? And for our competitors, you'll see director of real estate, director of facilities, right? Facilities manager. For us, you'll see controller, financial reporting manager, general ledger accountant, right? So you can tell right away just from looking at the reviews and looking at the ratings that we are accountants first, second, and third.
And then, so what do you need more of right now? Just more, it sounds like more team. You got to build your team, build the bench.
Yeah. So if you go to our website at www.leesquary.com, we have a careers page on there that tells you all the people that we're looking for. We are hiring at a tremendous rate.
And then they don't have to be here in Atlanta. They could be anywhere.
Well, no. We basically now we're requiring everyone to kind of be in Atlanta, in the Atlanta area. Just because we just signed a big lease down the street. No,
are you managing it properly?
Yes, we are. We are. I think the people that were negotiating the lease with us recognized really quickly that this is what we do for a living.
So at leasequary.com, you can see the opportunities that are available. And you mentioned that most people that work there are accountants, CPAs, and they have.
Yes, the vast majority of people, but we have other positions available, you know, customer success. So interestingly, what I think we've done with our model is we've taken the traditional accounting module, which is basically primarily a services organization, and moved it into the SaaS position, right? So even though we're a company that is run by accountants and we serve accountants, we're still very much a software company. So we're taking the model, the SaaS model, what we know works in that model, and we're just kind of taking that blueprint and putting it upon a traditionally services model.
Now, are you marketing it the same way SaaS companies market with SDRs going out there?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So people are making calls, they're setting up demos, they're moving it through the sales cycle the same way that most SaaS companies do?
We started doing that this year. As I said, last year, all that growth was funded by either referrals or people finding us on their own.
Right.
Now we've decided we want a more predictable SaaS model. And so, I mean, the vast majority of our hires now are SDRs.
And they're going out and calling on, what is this, the company? Well,
the beautiful thing about, once again, our service is that every company you call, needs this software.
So they're leasing up
something. Every company leases, right? I guarantee you, you guys do not own this building. You're leasing it. So if you have to issue GAAP financials, guess what? After the show, I'd like to talk to you.
And then is the sweet spot, they have $1 million in sales and they have 50 employees.
Like, so that's the challenge, right? You can't really determine or predict how much leasing a company does based on revenue, right? Mm-hmm. What the biggest predictable, the biggest predictor is, do you have to issue GAAP financials, right? Also, do you have more than 5 leased assets? That's really the number, right? Because the math is very complex. It's a present value calculation. And the challenge there is, I mean, not to get too technical, but normally when you amortize an asset, you use what's called straight line, right? The challenge is the amortization of the right of use asset. I'm sorry,
You have 5, then you need to know.
You need software, but a lot of people who have between 5 and 20 don't believe they need software, uh-huh. but they will recognize it really quickly after they go through an audit in the first quarter.
Right.
Then they'll know that they needed it.
That's absolutely right.
Well, congratulations and kudos to you for having the vision to see this.
Well, it's not.
You acted on it. You saw it and you acted on it.
Well, this is true. But one thing I will say is that normally I see and I hear people, entrepreneurs talk about, you know, being lucky in life. And I normally say in the back of my head, come on, you know, you think you're amazing, right? I have been really lucky to have, I've got, you know, Chris, who's really our SVP of sales. And he's the one who really catapulted this for us. Right. I've got an incredible team around me. Right. Russell and, you know, Andrew and Brendan. So all these are people who have been there from the start. Sherry, initial core group that came together and exploded this thing. So it's really I will be nowhere without them. Right. And so I like to say this is our company, not mine.
Well, you're being very gracious. And I think you should be, because it sounds like you're surrounded by some fantastic folks. But I find it so inspiring when someone like you and your team, you identify a need and then you go to work fulfilling that need.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it's all about, man. That's what
I always say. The easiest part of starting a company is starting a company, right? That's really and everyone always goes, oh my gosh, it's so hard. And I'm like, that's actually the easy part,
right?
The hard part is execution. And most people do not execute for a long time. I'd say even now. But for a long time, people would always say, aren't you afraid of your competition? Aren't you scared of your competition? And I go, absolutely not. In fact, the competition should be afraid of me, right?
Right.
For the longest time, people always ask us, how many employees do you have? And there's things that I call vanity metrics, right? Number of employees, that's one. How much capital have you raised? That's two. When we were 5 people, potential customers would always ask us, how many employees do you have? And I'd say around 20, right? I mean, around, how around are we talking about, right?
You're the accountant. I don't know what you can get away with. But now I know 5 is around 20.
Well, but in my mind, I'd say the more important question you should ask yourself or the more important metric is, how many clients have we lost?
Right.
And the answer at the time was zero, right? We've lost 3 clients now, and primarily through mergers. There was a merger and one company failed. And the third one, they didn't even use our product because they got another person in there that was comfortable with another product. Once, obviously, a real estate person. So that's really a vanity metric, the number of employees. Guess what? We've now caught up to our competition.
Right.
We're now at about 50, right? And then you also look at they always ask, how much capital have you raised? In that case, we've raised 0. Right, we have raised $0.
To me, 0 is the vanity metric.
Well, I'd be proud of that.
Well, but that's my point, right? Like the vanity metric is people go out there, oh yeah, we've raised $10 million. Well, that just tells that you're a good presenter,
right?
The purpose of a company, and maybe this is my experience as an accountant, is to make money and make happy clients, right? So those are metrics that we're proud of. We 0 churn, right? As far as I'm concerned, the people that we've lost, A1, as I said, never used our software. They hired a new person, and B, a merger, C, a company failed.
Right.
3 companies that we've lost. 0 churn.
All right. Well, LeaseQuery, LeaseQuery.com. You can go there. If you're an accountant, if they want to shake things up and go for a fun ride, it seems like that's a place to be.
Perfect.
All right. Hey, how about staying with us? We got a few more guests we're going to visit with this morning.
No, absolutely. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, we have with us President with Pitch and Present Communications. Please join me in welcoming to the show, Mr. Mark Dorfman. Good morning, sir.
Good morning to you, sir.
So what'd you learn in that last segment, man?
That I can get away with saying 20, 10, 5, 50. I like his style.
He's a presenter like you were talking about. So what are you out there doing for folks, man?
So when people ask me what I do, I tell them that I help people get what they want.
That sounds attractive.
Yeah, that's what I do.
I got a whole list here.
Yeah. So, you know, in business, when it comes to getting what you want, I categorize things into three finite buckets, you know, time, money, and effort, right? And so when we want something in business that requires one of those three from someone else, we know basically they don't want to give it to us. Why? Because their assets, their capital, their time. So in order to get these things from someone else who doesn't want to give it to us, we've got two ways to go about it. We got coercion and we have persuasion. Mm-hmm. We all know coercion, right? We've seen Goodfellas. We see how that works. I'm not in the coercion business. I'm in the persuasion business. So that's what I do. I help persuade other people to give us what we want.
But you're not the one actually persuading. You're teaching other people to persuade?
Yes. Yes. So I work with clients, right? So it could be individuals, people who present, TED Talks, academic conferences, to teams, sales teams, mm-hmm. Biz dev teams. And it's all through speaking and writing. So what we say and how we say it.
So now, do you see some common mistakes that people make? Maybe first-time speakers?
Well, I think the biggest mistake that people make is assuming you can do well at public speaking on your own. You know, so 99% of the people that I meet, if I ask them, so do you do public speaking? And they'll say, sure. I say, well, do you have a coach? And they look at me like, why would I do that? You know, why would I need a coach? We speak all the time and people say I'm really good. And I say, well, take a professional athlete, you know, who starts playing football, basketball, from the time they're old enough to dribble and toss, right? Until the time 30 years later at the Super Bowl, that athlete who's practiced one task every day has never done it without a coach, right? You would never think of a professional team going to the Super Bowl, the best of the best, without a coach. And in public speaking, you know, I work with a lot of entrepreneurs, Shark Tank folks. They've mortgaged a house, kids' college is on the line, and they get one shot and they go alone and they lose.
That level, the people are still going at it alone without help?
Well, the help they get is usually internal.
Like internal, like they asked their cousin?
So are there any lawyers in the room?
I don't think so.
I hate to say it because I love working with lawyers, but they're the worst. You know, lawyers, where do they get help? Other lawyers, right? It's within the firm. It's this way of doing business, the old way, the schmoozing way.
Right.
And, you know, the idea of bringing someone in like me who's not a lawyer, who's... You know, once I work with somebody, I've never met anybody I can't help. 10 minutes, I can help somebody. They stand up and speak and boom, 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 right? Life-changing, you know? But if no one helps you ever, how are you going to know what you're doing wrong? So even at that level, you'd be surprised at the people that I work with who've literally put everything on the line. It's make or break, you know? Same with, and it doesn't occur to them before meeting me that I should get some help.
So like when you're saying everything on the line, that it might be that they made it to Shark Tank, so they're going to be on the show, or they're in front of a venture capitalist and they're going to do a pitch to try to raise funds or...
Exactly. You know, a biotech incubator. You know, I worked with some tech companies back in New York. I work with the New Jersey Institute of Technology and their incubator. I work here with TAG, Georgia mm-hmm. Tech. And yeah, a real world, you know, all these companies, and they get a chance to get in front of someone who could really write a check. And you can see right away people that have gotten help and then people that just don't have a chance. And it's sad because You can have the best idea. If it stays in your head and you can't communicate it to someone else, then it doesn't matter. And of course, we're in a city of technology swarming with brilliant people. Can't communicate it well. And so...
So is it because they're too much into the technology and they're not into the story behind it or the value that the user would benefit from it? Like, what's the mistake that they're making?
Well, that's the key. So before I got into this business, I was in LA. I worked in Hollywood as a film producer. Mm-hmm. You know, there it's all about selling ideas. It's not even a piece of real estate, right? You're basically selling air. And what are you selling? Well, you're selling a story. And, you know, we all know great movies. It's the, you know, part of our generation. Stories. We've been telling stories since people have been writing, painting pictures on cave walls. And yeah, when people go out to present, you know, I always ask how many, out of what percentage of presentations that people in business sit through, what percent do you walk out and say, man, I wish I could sit through that again. That is an hour of time that everybody laughs, right? It's funny. So when I say what percent, you know, what percent of presentations that you sit through, are they amazing? What percent? You know,
it's a handful.
Yeah, not very many.
Like zero to
right.
Five.
And yet for every single one of them, somebody has invested weeks, months, money, and in 10 minutes, they're dead. Family, kids don't go to college, forget the mortgage on the house. And the terrible thing is they don't know why. I mean, isn't that terrible to just, can you imagine losing a football game and you never know why? There's no coach to tell you what you're doing wrong. And I see it all the time. It's terrible.
So when you're helping somebody put a presentation together or pitch together, so what are the must-haves inside the presentation or pitch?
Well, the first thing I do is I clear the decks and I go back to Hollywood. You know, everything we do, a movie is a presentation, a play is a presentation. It all starts with the script. I'm amazed at how many times companies or people will ask for a presentation in advance. And I would say, well, what does that mean? Well, send us your deck. It's a weird world for me. You know, when someone says, can you send me your presentation? I say, yes, send me the self-addressed FedEx box. I'll put myself in
inside.
It. And there's the presentation.
Because you're part of it.
I'm in. Right. I'm the subject. I'm the guy.
Right.
You know, you watch TED Talks. Steve Jobs. How many slides are there?
Right. They don't have slides.
Right. And we pay attention.
Right.
Right. But you go to every business presentation. There's a guy staring at a screen having a conversation with PowerPoint.
And it's just a kind of blocks of text.
It's awful. It is just truly awful. So the good news is the look on someone's face, especially just in how they present. Every couple of years they do these surveys and they ask people, what do you fear most in life? Single greatest fear. You know what it is every year, number one?
It's audited.
Getting on. Number one fear. What is the number one thing people are afraid of?
Public speaking.
Public speaking, followed by number two?
Death.
Right? So we know the old joke. At a funeral, more people would rather be in the box than giving the eulogy. Right? Isn't that kind of weird? Right. So, you know, the great thing is once people know that they're in the hands of somebody who actually knows what they're doing and they can relax, the change from... You know, even the best and the brightest, when you stand up in public, it can be terrifying. And to see someone go from that to just shining and confident, and it doesn't take a lot of work, that's amazing.
So when you're working with somebody who has this fear, how are you working with them? How do you give them the confidence to speak with confidence?
Well, by the time, here's the way I work. So I work backwards. Right. So by the time anyone actually has to speak, if they're working with me, they're ready. They're ready well in advance. They've already gone through the content. They've worked with me. Then it's just psychology. You know, what do you do game day? What do you focus on? But if you know you're prepared, like a good football team, good entrepreneur, there's nothing to fear. You've done your homework. You've done the work. Now it's just about doing your job.
Right. But you can say that, but I watch a lot of sports that under pressure, people collapse all the time.
You know, I don't know anything more, you know, Super Bowl is pressure, man. These guys get on the field.
Right. And then somebody missed an assignment. Somebody missed the block.
Right. But they don't run off the field crying or shaking, so too afraid to get on the grid.
Those things happen.
They do.
I mean, I've seen people give bad presentations. I've never seen somebody run crying off the stage before it began.
No, but I bet you've seen people lock up and forget what they're going to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Well, that to me is missing a block or dropping the ball.
Yeah, but we've worked out those kinks long in advance. So the biggest thing, here's what I tell people. By the time you're ready to present, okay, and it's an hour before, most people spend their time thinking about, they get a case of the what ifs. Right. They start thinking about all the what things that could possibly go wrong when they speak. And once you're focused on that, it's over. I mean, that's not where your head's got to be. So for what I do with my clients, I tell them that, look, you know, you're prepared. We've gotten this far. The only thing I want you to focus on is whether or not you're going to give your audience something of value. And of course, when you've worked with me, you've got 100 things you're going to give them. But I say, if you give them just one, and you're not awful, you've just done a better job than 99% of everyone else, if you just do that. Mm-hmm. And if you focus like that, it changes.
So you focus on the gift you're going to give the audience.
Always.
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 That's number one.
Always. Number one, it is never about you.
Sounds like fantastic counsel to me. Now, I think I've come across people with the opposite problem who aren't scared and should be because they're not very good. And they think that they're great. And I think in some bigger companies, it's a bit of a challenge because maybe it's your boss or your boss's boss. So have you ever run into that?
So I'll give you, yes. And the funniest story.
He works with lawyers.
Let's get off the lawyers. And I'm a Jewish guy. Let's go to the rabbis. Okay. So that's what you get. The congregation, the head of the congregation calls, not the rabbi, because he thinks he's doing a great job.
Right.
Right. But, you know, every, you know, Saturday sermon, you know what everyone is doing, right? Praying that it ends fast. Right. So the head of the temple or the church, whoever will call. And the first thing I'll say as well is the rabbi on board? You know, then, of course, it's quiet. And then, not really. It's like, well, don't you think he's going to, you know,
volunteer? Should get a heads up.
But it happens all the time. And that's a big problem, which is why bringing in a third neutral party from the outside takes the pressure off everyone
with persuasion
else.
Skills.
With persuasion
in
skills.
In his own right. The other thing I wanted to ask is, what about technology? Because, yes, there is the stand up in front of the group. But nowadays, there's these conference calls and
webinars.
And I mean, I know a CEO who has a webinar coming up Friday. I don't know if this guy's ready for this thing or not.
So you want some tips?
I want him to get some tips.
OK,
I'm just going to tell him he's doing a great job.
All right. So here's my thing. And I'm going to get yelled at. OK, if you've got first of all, if you're speaking into like the microphone in the middle of the conference table, we all do that. Right. There's the meeting. We're speaking into the microphone on the table or the webinar. So here's what I tell everyone. Dress like it's a live meeting. Act like it's a live meeting. And that microphone, whether it's in the middle of the room or attached to the computer, that is a person. And you need to speak to that person, make eye contact with that microphone, and give it all the energy that you can muster, just like that person's in the room, because people can tell. People can always tell, right? You know if someone's sleeping in their pajamas.
Right.
Right. We all know that. We all know that.
So you come with the appropriate energy.
Always.
Always. Now, what about...
By the way, let me give you a tip. So one of the things I tell people is the energy you bring to the room is the energy that fills the room. Mm-hmm. Think about that, right? Bruce Springsteen, got to go there.
Right.
Right? Big day, giant stadium. He had a bad night. Does he walk in? No.
He doesn't make his problem your problem.
No. He walks in and everyone's screaming and the boss goes on. And so that's a big thing, especially when we're dealing with technology. You know, we can't expect everybody to be excited, as excited about what we're talking about as we are. But with the energy, you got to go there like it's game day. You cannot let the energy drop to the level of the room, because if you get sound bored, everyone else is going to tune out.
Now, what about mechanics? Are there any tips to kind of remembering your talk?
Yes. Don't try to memorize.
Don't memorize.
No. No. So the key is, and I basically work in threes. You know, we attack, we build a structure just like a script, focus on the audience. What are the three key persuasion points that we're going to focus on? And if you need something to remind you of what you're going to say, take an index card. Forget the slides. Forget memorizing. Know your stuff. Look at a card just like a TED Talk. Boom. And you try to memorize. It sounds scripted. And then if you get stuck, then you got to rewind the tape and remember where you are.
So it's okay to kind of meander around a little bit?
All the time.
And if you try to memorize and someone asks you a question and then you kind of go off, then it's hard to know where to come back in, isn't it?
Well, that's the problem with 70 slides. How can you move around freely and engage an audience when you tell people, wait, can you do me a favor and hold that question for an hour and a half until I get to slide 625?
We're not there yet.
Disaster. Yeah. So people who know their stuff, like this gentleman over here that was just speaking, this guy's on fire. He doesn't need a script. He knows his stuff. And the more you know your stuff, the less you have to be scripted.
So then the audience picks up. He's passionate. He's smart. He's a trusted. I can trust him.
Right. And what I always tell folks that I work with in the startup world, companies bet on the jockey, not the horse. They know that from day one, a new business, the business plan goes in the toilet. Things go wrong.
Right.
And we're betting on the people. They got to show that they're smart, energetic, and problem solvers. I'm not looking at the financials. It's the people.
So how do you sell your services? Do you go out and do free talks and let people see that you know what you're talking about? Or how do you sell what you do? Because there's a lot of folks out there, I think. Isn't it kind of a crowded environment, your marketplace?
The marketplace is crowded in the sense that there are a lot of people out there talking about being communication skills people. But I've taken everything. I try to take every course I can get my hands on. I don't know anyone else that focuses singularly on working with someone in pitching and presenting for Shark Tank. That's it. I'm not going to give you theory. I'm not going to talk about stuff that happened 500 years ago. I go in there and the name of the game is we win.
But how do you get to have this conversation? Like tomorrow or next week, you got to go get you another client, right?
You know what? All I need is a conversation. Give me 10 minutes with somebody and I can point out something like it. So I see myself as a doctor with a tool bag and a stethoscope. All I have to do is give me 5 minutes, quick checkup, and we're going to find something to work on.
So your initial conversations are very
casual, asking questions.
Ask a few questions, and then if you think you can help them, you tell them that.
Yeah, so what I do is I offer a communication consultation. Just call me. I'm a content and delivery guy, so I can look at what you're saying, and then I can help you with how you're saying it. We talk on the phone for a few minutes, see if I can help. If I can, great. If not, and you're perfect and you're presenting, good luck.
And then for you, though, this engagement, is it just to get them ready or is this kind of, something that you hang around and you're doing maintenance throughout the year?
So it'll depend. With big corporate clients, they'll bring me in because they're rotating new people through. One-on-ones with people who are out there speaking, giving keynotes, C-level executives. It just depends. Usually it'll be a conversation the night before after we've worked on the content. But usually, once somebody has worked with me through the methodology and they understand how to structure an argument and what to look for in their actual presentation, I've given them the tools to practice and rehearse on their own. And then it's just fine tuning.
But there is a Dorfman methodology. There's some structure, rigor, discipline to the Dorfman approach.
Absolutely.
Have you boxed that? Like, do you plan to at some point? And sell it separate or does it need to be complemented with?
I don't know if I've boxed it other than if you work with me, you get it. But the one thing I will say is if you can sell somebody on a movie idea, which is just thin air, you can sell somebody on anything.
I believe you.
So now, are you looking for more corporate, like if you get in, you mentioned lawyers and we're kind of picking on them a little bit. Is that a good client for you, like a law firm so that they can put all of their lawyers through this type of training or CPA from the people, like a CPA would be to me more because they're not traditionally great speakers and they're kind of get technical and in the weeds of the accounting rather than the speaking and persuasion part, even though now a lot of them are charged with getting clients and having to bring accounts into play.
Yeah, for the last 4 years, I've focused on big platform training programs. The first half of my pitch and present was one-on-one, doing exactly what you were talking about. And that's what I'm focusing on now, is really one-on-one, high-level engagements. That's where the fun is. That's where you can do the real custom work. And we really, this is real world. My guys have to win. Right, that's what we're out there.
Right.
If you don't win, then we failed, and we got to work on it.
And then the company goes out of business, or the client loses.
Don't get the important deal anyway. Yeah,
yeah, you can see it right away. I mean, there's objective, real world here. You know, this isn't theory.
Like, right.
Either you get the sale, you make the deal, you close the financing, or you don't.
So now, if somebody wanted to learn more, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
You can reach me. My company is Pitch and Present Communications. We're www.pitchandpresent.com, and that's spelled out. And you can always call me on my cell, 323-252-9379. And that's my LA number, which I will not give up.
And then what about you still taking pitches for movie ideas?
Yeah, so here's what I tell everybody. Yeah, I get this all the time. Everyone's got a great idea for a movie. So I'll tell them, look.
Iron Man with a girl.
There we go. I said, let's start easy. Give me 3 pages with a story. Let's just start real simple. Give me 3 pages of a story idea. And in 20 years, I've never gotten one back.
That's a bridge too far for most people.
Well, good writing, good writing is the toughest thing to find. So, yeah. But hey, if you've got one, you can send me your 3 pages. I can raise the money. I need the 3.
Well, thanks so much for coming and hanging with us. Mark Dorfman with Pitch and Present Communications. And one more time, best coordinates, phone, email, whatever.
Yeah, so the phone is 323-252-9379. You can call or text me there. And online, it's pitchandpresent.com.
All right. Hey, stay with us. We got one more group we're going to visit with. All right, Lee, you ready for the headliner?
I am.
They've been very patient. They've been hanging out. I thought I saw one of them taking some notes a minute ago, but... it's now time to get to that segment. So next up on Atlanta Business Radio, please join me in welcoming to the show Roberto Hernandez and friend, and I don't think it's Cheryl, even though my paperwork said Cheryl.
Yeah, he is John Simpson.
All right, John, welcome to the show. And I know you guys are entrepreneurs, and we want to hear about your day job, but I think you've also got some ideas to share with us about some recent regulation and that kind of stuff. So yeah, lay it on us. So Roberto, tell us a little bit about your day job.
Okay, thank you so much for having me today.
Sure.
Well, I'm a business owner and I'm an artist. So what I do in my company is I do makeup from special effects, theatrical.
Another one in the movie business.
Man, they're everywhere.
Man, Georgia's like in the we're like Hollywood now. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, it's great. Yeah, like Atlanta has so many opportunities right now for people like me, you know, that are waiting for those situations to happen. The other thing that I do is I'm a costume designer. I also paint murals in Atlanta.
Cool.
And I'm probably missing one thing. Yeah, I do like many, many different things. In order for me to stay alive as an artist, I had to learn how to do everything.
But you're not a starving artist. Do you have an ongoing concern? You got clients, you got work.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I'm no longer a starving artist. That is correct.
Oh, but you were at one time.
Absolutely. For many, many years.
Well, you are the skinniest one in the room. We said maybe our producer, Katie.
So talk about pursuing art as a profession. What was that like, making that decision, knowing that it was going to be hard at first and then just kind of sticking with it through the tough times?
Right. Well, I'm a DACA recipient, and I don't know if many of you know, in our political climax right now, it was very difficult for me to even enter school when I was in high school or college, apply for college, because I didn't have the paperwork in order for me to even enroll in a university. So I had to go to different places basically to talk to different deans of different universities so they could actually listen to my story and see if they could help me out. And eventually I got an approval from Georgia State University. And they were like, okay, we understand your situation. We're going to help you out. and this is what you are going to do. So I went there for 4 years and I got my degree in drawing and painting. And
this all got done before the recent formal regulation thing?
Right.
Georgia State worked with you on this.
Georgia State worked with me on that. This was about 10 years ago. So there was no DACA, nothing.
Right,
nothing that could even help me to achieve anything. So
so you were very persuasive. You took a couple of pages out of Mark's book, right?
Right. And you know, like I'm a very shy person. So for me at that age to come and talk to people and, yeah. and tell them like, please listen to me. I want this was extremely difficult. So yeah, eventually I got into Georgia State. I got a tuition waiver and that's where I lost a lot of weight because I had to get,
not only can you come to our school, we waived your tuition.
Right.
Man, are you looking for any sales work? I think there's three people right here in this room that might hire you.
Right. Well, it came at a cost because I had to get a high grade, point average.
Okay.
And that's when things got really, really crazy for me because I had to work extra hard than most of my friends, you know, especially because I'm not, English is not my first language. So that meant that I had to stay after school and go to English labs and math labs and science labs just to like catch up with everything. But then after I graduated from college, I came to the realization that I wasn't going to be able to find a job. Or not find a job, be able to be employed legally in the U.S. So that's when a lot of my depression and madness came, you know, for about 4 years, things were a little bit too rough for me. And it was until the new Obama regulation, DACA, that I was finally able to get a work permit, open up my two businesses. I own two. One is a restaurant that I opened up with the help of my mother. And it was for my mother because that was her dream.
Do you still have the restaurant?
I still have it, yeah. It's in a Hispanic shopping center in Plaza Fiesta, near Brookhaven and Claremont Road and Beaufort Highway.
Well, Lee probably knows it. He knows every restaurant between here and, I don't know, Savannah. Don't you?
I eat out a lot.
And the other business that I opened was Roberto's Artwork LLC, which is what I used to do all of my arts.
And decorate the restaurant, right?
And yes. Yeah, there's murals right. everywhere.
You got to keep it in the family. We do exactly. the same thing at Business Radio X.
Now, who'd you bring with you today?
My friend, John.
So I'm here with Roberto to sort of talk about the policy behind DACA, where we're headed.
Let's start with what the letters stand for.
Sure.
What's your background?
I do policy analysis. I look at things that are going through the Georgia legislature, things that are going through Congress to understand what the implications of those are for people like Roberto.
So you're a lawyer?
I'm not a lawyer by education.
If you are, we're sorry because we've been hammering lawyers all morning.
It's a tough room for a lawyer. So I'm fortunate. Fortunately, I'm not one. But I work with a lot of lawyers reviewing, you know, what laws... legislation says, what pending laws might, how they might impact.
So you're an advocate?
I am. I'm working with an organization that folks may know of called Forward.us. It is an immigration nonprofit started by Mark Zuckerberg to increase legal immigration and provide more high-skilled immigrants to our business community.
So now, how'd you run into Roberto?
Earlier this year, as probably a lot of people know, the president in September had said they were going to end the DACA program, which stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. These are people who came to the United States illegally as children. Their parents brought them with them, have since grown up, are members of our community, have been educated in our schools, but for no fault of their own, do not have legal status here in the United States. So what the Obama administration did is they provided these children, all of them are adults now, provided them with work authorization in the United States through a program called the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program. You probably have also heard them termed dreamers. It's the same. It's one and the same. Roberto is a dreamer, a DACA recipient. He was actually brought here when he was a child, and he's got a fantastic story that I'll let him tell. But in September, the president said he was going to end this program. He said he was going to give it a 6-month phase out, which would have made it end in March, March 5th. It was supposed to end. Some court challenges have kept it alive, but it causes some serious concerns for folks like Roberto on what their future status may be, whether Roberto could continue to have his business. And there's a general feeling amongst, I would say there's a general political idea that somehow immigration takes American jobs. That's not necessarily true, especially in the case of Roberto. He's actually, immigrants are overwhelmingly entrepreneurial. Someone like Roberto is actually creating jobs by having his own company and serving the need of the business community at large, folks that need, particularly in the film industry, folks that need makeup artists, they need costume design, they need set design. These are all skills that he's bringing to the table that would otherwise may not be fulfilled.
Now, you're here to educate us about the current situation. And are you here also, do you advise Roberto on his options and his choices? Is that your role as well? Or are you just a friend of his? Or
Mostly, Roberto and I have met through this process, mostly as a friend of his. Certainly, we know folks that can, we know attorneys that can, mm-hmm. can help folks that need assistance. Our organization, forward.us, is always looking for folks that are immigrants that want to get their story out, want to help encourage more legal immigration in the United States.
And you're doing that just by kind of spotlighting them and letting them tell their story and then let the American public decide if this is an issue that's important enough for them to.
Exactly. Exactly. Around. So, and as these issues move through Congress, highlighting the issues, today is actually an important day. Today is known in the business community. There's probably a lot of people who are anxious today because it is what we call H-1B day. It is the first day mm-hmm. that companies can apply for H-1B visas. Depending on how you look at it, there's between 65 and 85,000 H-1B visas that are available. We have a need. There will be about 250,000 applicants, so just about 30% will actually get one of those visas. And if you look at what our high-skilled need is in the United States over the next 10 years, we probably need 1 million immigrants, high-skilled immigrants, to fill those visas. Mm-hmm. And we're only giving out 65,000 per year. And that's that need is based on, it's not taking American jobs, because that need is calculated based on the number that we're producing in our universities. It's just the fact that our STEM economy is growing that fast. And everybody wants our STEM economy to grow. But if we don't have the people that can fill those jobs, we can't grow as fast as we want to grow. So that's another issue that is going to be percolating here in the next few weeks.
So now, Roberto, when you have John here talking about the politics of it, you're kind of living it.
Right.
So he spoke about the uncertainty. So how do you deal with that uncertainty, knowing that the politics of today is different than the politics of a couple of years ago when there was a different administration? So how are you managing this? What are your choices?
I really don't think about it, you know, like
that's one way.
Right.
That's an approach. There's a few topics that I approach that way.
Right. You know, like I understand that, you know, at any time my life can go into absolute mm-hmm. chaos. Because of the political climax that we're going on right now. But I try to think about just my company, my business, my vision. And, you know, whatever happens, I'll deal with it in the best way I can when the situation arrives. But I'm trying to stay positive in it.
But, I mean, if the American climate isn't conducive to your work, I mean, it's this big planet. You know, the world's flat nowadays. Is there other choices for you in other places?
I'm absolutely sure. Yeah, I haven't really contemplated the scenario that what if, and I should start looking at different choices elsewhere and see what happens. But because for one, my family is here, my business is here, my whole life is here.
Right.
But I'm pretty sure that there are choices, and I know that, you know, with my skill and my and you know my understanding of art and my experience.
Right, your talent and your drive, you'll probably be successful wherever you go.
Right, hopefully.
Right. So now, John, what's the counsel to people? I mean, is it just you just wait?
Well, I think that's fortunately we have a Congress that understands that we need reasonable business immigration. But the counsel to people is to reach out to their members of Congress. It is for business owners to reach out to their members of Congress and explain to them, you know, we're in an extremely tight labor market. That's one of the benefits of having the economy that we have today. And we need more people to service our clients. We need more talent. And ultimately, immigration raises all boats because immigrants tend to push native-born workers into higher earning professions. So getting that message out to members of Congress and getting, you know, having shows like this that are willing to talk about immigration and why it's so important to businesses is really sort of the next step to ensuring that someone like Roberto has a future here in the United States. And when you were talking about, you know, where does Roberto go next? That's sort of the great thing about the United States and the American dream is that everyone wants to come to the United States. So we get our pick of the best and the brightest from around the world. Mm-hmm. And we shouldn't, the more that we restrict our immigration here in the United States, the less that's true. And they're going to start saying, well, maybe I want to live the Canadian dream.
Yeah, start thinking like Lee was asking a minute ago. He's asking about different places you could do it. Absolutely. So before we wrap, I want to pull Mark Dorfman back into this conversation because this strikes me as a really robust challenge, but also opportunity. We've got a branding project here. We've got a persuasion presentation project here. We've got a strong education component because you want to educate everybody, including middle-aged white guys, that legal immigration is good business.
Absolutely.
Am I articulating that properly?
Absolutely.
So, I mean, Mark, this is doable, right? But we just got to put some discipline, some rigor, some structure around doing it.
Yeah. Again,
you agree with this?
Yeah. It's all doable. Just got to convince the other people.
So how would you go about convincing people? Do you think their strategy of telling stories, bringing people to the forefront that have kind of struggled in this country, rose above, got, created their own job. Is you think that that's the secret to getting the word out and getting, because ultimately, yeah, no matter who's in charge as president, Congress makes laws. I mean, the Congress people ultimately make the laws that decide what's what.
So when I talk to someone and for me, it's about credibility, right? So, or offense and defense, right? So on the offensive side, you've got to be persuasive, mm-hmm. right? You've got to have your talking points, your persuasion points, telling a good story. The defensive side, and this is where things go really bad, especially in the world of politics, is that if there's no data to support whatever you're saying, and I'm not speaking specifically to whatever we're discussing here. But if there's no data, a smart investor or a smart audience, you immediately, there's no credibility. So for example, on the business side, if someone says, I'm going to help you make a lot of money, the first thing someone's going to ask is, well, how much?
Right.
And how much did you help the last guy make?
That's exactly right. So as soon as we go into the broad and the macro world, we're inviting other people to call us when we focus on the real micro data world. And so one of the things that I think is very important, especially in the realm of political speech and rhetoric, is you've got to support your arguments with real empirical data. And if the data is wrong, your argument's over. We all know. Assume somebody throws up something that we think is BS, we immediately, we discount that.
But do you like to blend the hard data and
compelling
stories? Do you like that blend? Because I do.
You got to, it's the data and the story. If you combine those, you got a winning ticket.
I think I agree. Yeah.
I just have to work a little bit harder on my persuasion.
Well, I think you have a good story. I think you've got a good story, and you don't sound very shy to me, at least not anymore.
Oh, when you're a starving artist and you're trying to sell your work to someone, it will push you to like not be shy anymore.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's sales 101. All right, Roberto, if somebody wants to get a hold of your artwork, what's the best? What, you have a website?
I don't have a website, right? It's very interesting because I've never had a website. I never had business cards. So in the business aspect, I've been, you know, word of mouth for a very long time.
What about Facebook?
I do have a Facebook. My Facebook is Roberto's Artwork LLC, and my Instagram is Roberto's Artwork.
And then, John, if somebody wants to learn more?
To learn more, to get more information on immigration, to get all your facts, you can check out forward.us or newamericaneconomy.org. Newamericaneconomy.org has all the facts and figures that we discussed today.
Good stuff. Well, thank you both for being part of the show today and sharing your story.
Thank you very much
for having us.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton, our producer, Katie Galley, and all the guests we had here today. We will see you next time on Atlanta Business Radio.